Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Tonight, we have a lecture from Nobel laureate and Pardee visiting professor Dr. Murray Gell-Mann. Dr. Gell-Mann is a renowned theoretical physicist and a distinguished fellow at the Santa Fe Institute, a private, nonprofit, multidisciplinary research and education center founded in 1984. He received the Nobel Prize for his work in elementary particle theory. His recent work has focused on complex adaptive systems that learn or evolve by using acquired information. Dr. Gell-Mann's lecture is entitled Regularities and Randomness in the Past and Future. He is introduced by Professor David Fromkin, director of the Frederick S. Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer-Range Future. Professor Fromkin.
My name is David Fromkin, and as director of the Frederick S. Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer-Range Future, I welcome you to tonight's speech in the Pardee Lecture Series given by our Pardee visiting professor, Nobel laureate Murray Gell-Mann, distinguished fellow of the Santa Fe Institute and author of The Quark and the Jaguar, Adventures in the Simple and the Complex. Besides being a Nobel laureate, Professor Gell-Mann has received the Ernest O. Lawrence Memorial Award of the Atomic Energy Commission, the Franklin Medal of the Franklin Institute, the Research Corporation Award, the Carty Medal of the National Academy of Sciences, and many, many honorary doctoral degrees from institutions that include Yale, the University of Chicago, universities of Cambridge and Oxford in England. And in 1988, he was listed on the United Nations Environmental Program Roll of Honor for environmental achievement. Professor Gell-Mann is the Robert Andrews Millikan Professor of Theoretical Physics Emeritus at the California Institute of Technology. He's director of the MacArthur Foundation, member of the National Academy of Sciences, a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, a fellow of the American Physical Society, a foreign member of the Royal Society of London, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, a former citizen regent of the Smithsonian Institution, a former member of the President's Science Advisory Committee, and currently a member of the President's Committee of Advisors on Science and Technology. Although a theoretical physicist, Professor Gell-Mann's interests extend to many other subjects, many of which we may hear about in the moments to come. Professor Gell-Mann.
Well, thank you very much, David, for that kind introduction. I approach this with a little trepidation. I know even less about the longer-range future than most people. But maybe there are some of my thoughts that are worth sharing with you. I'll try anyway. You heard that I work at the Santa Fe Institute these days. I helped to found it about 20 years ago. In fact, we're about to celebrate our 20th anniversary. It's almost entirely a visiting institution where scientists and sometimes scholars or even artists are in residence for periods ranging from a few days, years or so. And together with those not in residence, they form a worldwide network, a kind of family. The relevant observational or experimental research is carried on mostly elsewhere. So the work at SFI is nearly all theoretical or based on computer modeling and simulation. And of course, careful attention is paid to the facts as revealed by observation, even if we don't develop those facts ourselves. A great deal of the work is pure research driven by curiosity, but some is motivated by applications, and there's a large consortium of business enterprises from around the world, the SFI Business Network, that helps to support SFI and sponsors topical meetings at which issues of possible applications of our ideas are discussed. And there are provocative interchanges among the business representatives as well as between them and the researchers. SFI research is inherently transdisciplinary, We found that among the best scientists and scholars, there are many who long for collaboration with other brilliant researchers trained in fields very distant from their own. In universities, such collaborations are difficult to arrange. And in fact, they encounter barriers nearly everywhere, not only in the form of university departments, curricula, degree requirements, and so on, but also through institutions such as professional societies and journals. But the enthusiasm of those researchers who are eager to collaborate helps to overcome those barriers, as well as others, perhaps even more important, that stem from differences in terminologies, methods, and ways of thinking. When we founded SFI, I did a good deal of the telephoning, this is almost 20 years ago, to invite some distinguished scientists to our early meetings. Ones we had heard might be interested in transdisciplinary work. Many of them were trained in fields very different from the one in which I was known, and they'd barely heard of me or perhaps didn't know my name at all. And I was certain that the reply would be like this, what you're doing sounds interesting, but I'm quite busy with my research and teaching, the books I'm writing, and my consulting work. Please don't call me. I'll call you. Instead, the answers tended to be more like this. I've been waiting for this opportunity all my life. May I come sooner? There are significant parallels, mathematical parallels, if nothing else, between phenomena in very different sciences. And it's natural, if barriers are removed, for theoreticians of different backgrounds to form transdisciplinary teams spontaneously, or sometimes in response to some kind of request for proposals, to exploit those similarities. A great deal of our research is connected in one way or another with issues of simplicity and complexity, regularities and randomness, complex adaptive systems, including biological evolution and various aspects of social evolution. Charles DeLisi, Vice Provost at BU, Nancy Coppell, and David Campbell, distinguished members of the BU faculty, are among the advisors and members of our family of researchers. So there are significant ties between the two institutions. We all notice that nearly everything any of us encounters exhibits regularities along with random or incidental features. All around us, we find this interplay of law and chance. Closely related to regularities and randomness is the distinction between the simple and the complex. What is complexity? Well, it would take many different concepts, many different quantities, to capture all of our notions of what's meant by complexity or its opposite, simplicity. But there's one quantity that corresponds best to what we mean in everyday speech and in most scientific discourse by complexity, and that's what I call effective complexity. In non-technical language, the effective complexity of an entity is the length of a very concise description of its regularities as distinct from features treated as random or incidental. Complexity does not mean randomness. So we could have, for instance, a complex novel, one with a lot of very different scenes, very different characters, very different subplots, and so on. Or we could, as in Peanuts, have a simple novel. That's the one Snoopy likes. I like a book where there's only one character and nothing happens to him. Now, sometimes what's regularity and what's randomness somewhat context dependent. Take signal and noise on the radio. Obviously, the music is signal and the static is noise. But as you know, in the 1930s at Bell Labs, Karl Jansky was asked to look at where static came from, and he discovered that it came from a particular place in the sky, and later they found other places in other constellations that were emitting static, and that was the basis of radio astronomy. So it turns out there are huge regularities concealed in the question of where static comes from. In fact, the whole science of radio astronomy. So regularity turned out to be a big part of it. So we looked for regularities. In science, we looked for regularities. Science, of course, was called natural philosophy in the 17th century when the Royal Society was founded. Natural philosophy because you look to nature to answer questions instead of sitting in your chair and speculating about what was right and what wasn't. Isaac Newton wrote about regularities. It is the business of natural philosophy to find them out. Now, about complexity, where does it come from? Well, the universe is governed by the fundamental laws of physics, which are two, really. There's a unified quantum theory of all the particles, the basic building blocks of matter and their interactions. And then there's the initial condition of the universe near the beginning of its expansion, 13 billion years ago or so. And that's it. And these are both thought by theoreticians these days to be quite simple. So where does effective complexity come from? Well, the answer is that the fundamental laws are probabilistic. They're not fully deterministic. I won't go into why or how that's true, but they are probabilistic. So the history of the universe is co-determined by these simple fundamental laws and an unimaginably long sequence of chance events or accidents governed by probabilities. I give here an example of the emission of a particle by a radioactive nucleus. Say it's an alpha particle, all directions in that case are equally probable, but it's only after the particle is emitted that we can tell where it went. There's no way beforehand to tell where it's going to go. All the directions are equally probable. You just have probabilities. So we can look at the alternative histories of the universe as forming a branching tree with probabilities at all the branchings. And Jorge Luis Borges, in a wonderful story, told about a man who had left at his death a mysterious garden, which was finally interpreted. It was a map of the alternative histories of the universe. El jardín de senderos que se bifurcan, the garden of forking paths. Now, some of these branchings, some of these accidents, produce much more future regularity than others, at least over finite regions of space and time. And these we can call frozen accidents. And they're the main source of effective complexity. They are the source of most regularities that we observe. Most of the regularities we observe do not come directly from the fundamental laws. They come from a conspiracy of accidents and the fundamental. For example, take a nasty little fluctuation that gave rise to our galaxy. On a cosmic scale, not very important probably, but to anything in this galaxy, like all of us, it's pretty important that it came into being. And that would have to be regarded as a frozen accident. And there are all the sciences except particle physics and cosmology. All the other sciences have some degree, more or less, of dependence on historical accident. All the other sciences depend to some extent on accidents. Chemistry even, because chemistry needs atoms and molecules, and there are lots of places where things are too hot for atoms and molecules, like the center of the sun. There's no chemistry there, very little. There's nuclear physics. But in the very early moments of the universe, there wasn't even nuclear physics. It was too hot. So you need to have some kind of conditions, special conditions for those. When you get to geology, of course, it's extremely dependent on historical accident, on the formation of the Earth with its special circumstances. Biology depends on not only on that, but also on the initial ancestral life form and all the accidents of biological evolution happened since, and so on and so forth. So there's always this delicate interplay of regularity and randomness. And we can look at these branching, at this branching tree of history, no matter at what scale, whether we're looking at it on the scale of fundamental physics or whether we're looking at it in the much more coarse-grained scale of human history. In either case, we see this interplay of regularity and randomness. So at both scales, we can think in terms of frozen accidents contributing to a whole range of regularities that are not inherent in the fundamental laws alone, but need these accidents. Now, there are historians of human affairs, and more of them as time goes on, who are tolerant of speculation about contingent or what-if history, and they're growing in number. Some articles about particular counterfactual speculations, as they call them, are to be found in at least three books that I know of, three recent ones. There's What If, number one, What If, number two, and a compilation by Neil Ferguson. And in all cases, the authors of these articles have picked out a number of apparently random events that may, as frozen accidents, have divided the branching history after them into well-defined domains. But historians have long disputed to what extent these wounds in the fabric of history remain indefinitely as scars, and to what extent they are eventually healed by grand historical forces. This is related to the dispute between the great person, great idea view of history and the great historical force view of history. For instance, we can look at the European Union today and ask to what extent its development was essentially inevitable and to what extent it should be thought of as resulting from the genius and foresight of Jean Monnet and his founding of the Action Committee for the United States of Europe. Following quotations are from Mark Sullivan's book, Our Times, The United States, 1900 to 1925. Carlyle, historian of the French Revolution. All things that we see standing accomplished in the world are properly the outer material result, the practical realization and embodiment of thoughts that dwell in the great men sent into the world. Walt Whitman, produce great persons, the rest follows. Or, on the other side, George Bernard Shaw. The world is finally governed by forces expressing themselves in religions and laws which make epochs, rather than by vulgarly ambitious individuals who make rows. Here's Louis Napoleon. I translate. March at the head of the ideas of your century. Those ideas follow you and sustain you. March behind them, they drag you with them. March against them, they overthrow you. William Jennings Bryan, in a letter to Mark Sullivan, you're entirely correct in describing public men as the creatures of their age. I've often used the same explanation in regard to myself. I lived in the very center of the country out of which the reforms grew and was quite naturally drawn to the people's side. If we look at these published collections of counterfactual speculations, we soon encounter the story of Buffalo Bill's Wild West show touring Europe in 1889. Many of you have heard it. The star was, of course, the noted female marksman Annie Oakley. She would challenge the men in the audience, asking for a male volunteer to smoke a cigar and let her shoot the ash off the end. Normally, there were no male volunteers. Her husband, himself a noted marksman, would step forward, start to smoke a cigar, and have the ash shot off by his wife. When the show reached Berlin, however, there was a male volunteer, the Kaiser, Wilhelm II. He had come to the throne just the previous year after the premature death of his father, Friedrich, son-in-law of Queen Victoria. The Kaiser came forward, pulled out an expensive Havana cigar, clipped off the end, removed the band, lit the cigar. As the ash grew at the end, he waited for Annie to shoot. She was worried. She'd been drinking quite a lot the night before. Her husband was one thing, the Kaiser was another. After a while, she took aim and fired, and we know what happened. The Kaiser was unharmed. But he went on to fire Bismarck, to cancel the reinsurance treaty with Russia, to engage in a naval arms competition with Great Britain, to contribute in other ways to the tragedy of the First World War. What if Annie had killed him? Would the World War have taken a different course? Would it have occurred at all? In a talk I gave some years ago to the International Institute for Applied Systems Analyses in Luxembourg, near Vienna, I mentioned the role of chance in the branching alternative histories. I alluded to such incidents and how they appear to affect history profoundly, as do assassinations, the results of famous battles, the lives of great persons, and so on. Fortunately, I mentioned also the countervailing arguments about grand historical forces. I say fortunately because a gentleman named Cesare Marchetti, trained like me as a physicist, got up to argue strongly against the tyranny of the individual chance events. And if I hadn't mentioned some other point of view favorably, I'm sure he would have attacked me. As it was, we got on famously. However, we were thinking of different things. He was not thinking so much about the kind of historical forces to which I was alluding. He was thinking rather of mathematical regularities, approximate mathematical laws that seemed to go on holding without reference to specific events or individual people. They go on marching while the circumstances change underneath them. He provided me with many examples that he'd collected, some of which I plan to share with you. But let me start with another one provided by somebody else, the distinguished Russian journalist Sergei Petrovich Kapitsa, also a former physicist and the son of the very famous physicist Pyotr Kapitsa. He took a very crude look at the time variation in human world population using this differential equation. The rate of change of the world population is proportional to the square of the world population, approximately. This isn't such a crazy idea, but since it takes two people to make one. So it's not totally crazy to take the square of the population here. The solution to this equation is trivial. It's just the world population is a constant over a certain critical time minus the time. You will notice that this goes to infinity at the time capital T, so it can't be exactly correct, this equation. N goes to infinity at capital T. But anyway, let's try to fit it. You try to fit it, you get pretty good results if you put T equal to 2025. Then up to about 1975, it works quite well. 1975, 4 billion. 1925, 2 billion. 1825, 1 billion. All the way back to quarter of a billion in 1225, eighth of a billion in 425. It's not so far from estimates that people have given of world population. Now, this equation has to be corrected at both ends. You have to add a term to the differential equation that will affect n of t strongly after 1975 to prevent it going from to infinity. Then there's another term that you have to add to reduce n of t by a big factor thousands and thousands of years ago. This gives a couple of million, for instance, 100,000 years ago when there were only a handful of people. That's when people, today's kind of people, just began. So you need two different correction terms. But between, say, 425 and 1975, it works. This equation works pretty well, and it's a very simple equation. Now, what that means is, think about it, it means that, say, 700 years ago, if there had been a scholar of world population writing down this trivial equation, and that scholar had had access to world population data, that person could have predicted the time when world population would have to turn over, would threaten to go to infinity and would have to have its point of inflection and start to level off. So the time around 2000, CE 2000, would be predictable hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago without any knowledge of contraceptives or technology change or changes in the education of women or any of the things that we associate with the underlying mechanisms, just the equation and putting in a couple of numbers from observation. Now, of course, we don't know of such a person in around 1300 who had access to such data, but that doesn't matter. The point is, it was the information was there to be exploited in this way. Let's take a very familiar example, Moore's Law. Observation by Gordon Moore, co-founder of Intel, long chairman of the board of Caltech, where I used to work, that the information capacity per unit area of computer chips is increasing exponentially. In fact, doubling every 18 months. It's been going on for years, since the 1980s, I believe. Of course, it can't continue forever. But people speculate that it won't start to level off for another decade or two, perhaps when the relevant size gets down to atomic dimensions. Now, neither of these simple laws is fully explained, in my opinion. Neither is another one. This one is kind of weird, and I don't understand it very well myself, but it's a favorite of Cesare Marchetti. What he does is he copies this from somebody, a man called Grübler, in an inaccessible thesis in Heidelberg. But anyway, what this person looks at is how far people are likely to travel in a day, on the average, using the vehicles available in their time with the mix of vehicles that people were actually using. So, and it's done for France. It starts in 1800, where the mix is mostly horses. And then it goes on, and the horses decline, and you get railways, and the railways decline, and you get buses and cars, and you get airplanes, and so on and so on. You get the train grande vitesse, the rapid railway train, and so forth. All of these things rise and fall, but you get this steady curve when you add it all up with the mix of vehicles. Pretty much an exponential, because this is a log plot over here. This is just time, and this is a log plot. So it's pretty much a straight exponential with increase of something like 3.8% per year in the distance traveled. Here it is in meters, here it is in kilometers. Now, how is it that these vehicles add up somehow? The mix of vehicles adds up to allow this steady change. All the mechanisms are changing with time, and yet you get this steady change. Very peculiar situation which repeats over and over again. Now, when something increases exponentially, call it y, the differential equation is dy dt equals ay. That's how we get these various exponentials that we've just been talking about. Eventually, such a thing has to be corrected. It can't go on forever. As some famous economist said, when something goes on forever, it doesn't. When something can't go on forever, it doesn't. So this can't go on forever. And what's natural then is to get another term in the equation so that you get an S-curve. And the simplest equation of that kind is this one. dy dt is ay times the factor 1 minus y over capital Y. Capital Y is then the asymptotic value at which the variable little y eventually levels off. This is called the logistic equation, as most of you know. Constant y is the asymptotic value as the time gets very large. This fraction, little y over capital Y, we can call f. Then we can eliminate capital Y from the equation. We just get a solution in terms of capital F. And what happens is that the log of capital F over 1 minus capital F is linear in time. In fact, it's equal to a constant times time minus a midpoint in time. This is the midpoint of the S-shaped curve. It's the point where the fraction f is 1 half. Then f over 1 minus f is 1, and its logarithm is 0. So t equals m corresponds to this thing equals 0, which means f equals 1 half. So little y has attained half of its asymptotic value at this midpoint. So Cesare has millions and millions of these things. Here it is applied to a plague. Works for almost any plague. Here it is for the famous Great Plague of London in 1665. Ran its course within the year 1665. And here are the data points, which are very good. This is from Defoe's Journal of the Plague Year. Samuel Pepys's diary also gives the figures. And here, log f of 1 f over 1 minus f plotted on log paper, so it's really log f of 1 minus f, is linear in time. And here are the dots. Works very well. Don't have to know anything about the mechanism. Just works. Now, the production of a great painter or a great composer or a scientist, same deal. Here's Botticelli. Now, of course, Cesare is not capturing qualitative things here, and that's a very important weakness of this whole approach. The really important things are often qualitative, and here you're just counting pictures. Of course, Botticelli didn't produce that many bad pictures, so counting pictures is a pretty good sign of his work. But you see, his production reached a peak here in the middle and came down, and this is the cumulative production. Just as we had cumulative casualties for the plague, So here we have cumulative production of Botticelli, and log f of 1 minus over 1 minus f is linear in time. It all works fine. Delta t is the time between 10% saturation and 90% saturation in the work of the, in this case, the artist. It's 39 years. Here's Tintoretto, same idea. Of course, the work is interrupted by death, but in many cases near the end of the production. Well, we don't have to do all the painters. Here's a composer, Bach, the great Bach, the father. These points fall a little bit below, but after that they follow the straight line pretty well. Mozart fits very well, but cut off by death at the age of 35 years. Terrible tragedy to die so young. However, he'd already done everything. According to Cesare. I don't know what that signifies, but it's very interesting. Shakespeare, counting plays. Cesare was delighted to find that this play, which gets you off the straight line a little bit, was finally not attributed to Shakespeare. The physicist Boltzmann also fits curve quite well, except at the very beginning. And he committed suicide at this point, presumably clinically depressed. He was also sad that people didn't understand his work in physics very well. He really believed in molecules, for example. Lots of people thought they were just some sort of vague idea. Just for a joke, Cesare made up some curves for me. Double, because I used to work on particle physics and now on this kind of stuff. So he's got two curves. See, here are the two S-shaped curves. Here's the differential form, two peaks. So he did this as a joke. Now, here's a completely different problem. Same idea, works beautifully. Cumulative fertility of American women. Beautiful straight line. And there are many other things to which it applies. So the general idea then is that we have these regularities that just go on and on and on and on without concerning oneself with the details underlying them. The cumulative casualties in any war have a tendency to follow the same logistic curve, independent of famous generals and famous battles. And Cesare rubs his hands together that he loves that idea. Doesn't matter about the generals, doesn't matter about the battles, and so on and so forth. And he likes to think of clockwork geniuses. But again, it's only very general features that are being described here. Many of the really important qualitative features, and what happens to the issues in the war, and so on and so forth, all of these things are not being included. So if this is not a point of view that one can use to describe the world, it's a point of view that picks out certain things that seem to be sort of mechanical and largely independent of mechanism. But it hardly is an assurance that that's the best way to describe the whole world. At the Santa Fe Institute, we're often concerned with attempts to construct simple models or simulations for very complex real phenomena, say in the life sciences or in the social and behavioral sciences. And we hope to treat some phenomena of human history in the same manner. But how do we judge whether such a model is successful? In science, in theoretical science, normally, a scientist would test a theory by comparing its predictions with the results of observation. But here we're dealing with theoretical models, whether they're computer-based or analytical, theoretical models that are so simplified that it would be astonishing, even embarrassing, to find agreement with observation, detailed agreement with observation. It's impossible. So what do you do? Well, most of us are convinced that the best course of action is to look at what you might call middle-level theory, that is, to find semi-empirical regularities in the real world that might be reproduced in the model, then to try to find reasons why they might exhibit a kind of continuity all the way from the real world of complexity down to the highly simplified model. If so, then one can try to find an explanation for the regularities in the model, perhaps not such a difficult task as in the complex real world, and then have some hope of extending that explanation to the complex reality. And that notion fits in very well with what we're doing here when we call attention to regularities in human history and the social sciences, particularly ones that could have been used in the past to predict certain gross features of history fairly well without going into detailed mechanisms. You notice that people in the 13th century could have predicted that this would be the time when world population would start to level off. Similarly, in the 19th century, they could have predicted something about the average distance traveled on a vehicle now without knowing anything about the airplane. They would get the right number without knowing the vehicle, and so on. That fits in very well with that kind of program we were discussing. It just touches certain features. But it is important. It constrains predictions of the future. These regularities exert considerable constraints on attempts to predict the future. And likewise, they exert some constraints on attempts to affect society by means of public policy. We'll get to that in a moment. But in order to do either of those things, it's very important to know whether we're dealing with a real regularity or a phony one. So here's an example of one that has been challenged. Many economists considered that the fraction of gross domestic product in labor income was a constant, somewhere between 60% and 70%, and they quoted lots of figures to show that it was remarkably constant at 60% to 70%. Now here the noted economist Bob Solow wrote a note saying that he didn't think that this really meant much, because what was remarkably constant? How constant was remarkably constant? And so on and so forth. And in this note, he goes on to quibble more and more and more with the notion that 60% to 70% is actually remarkably constant. But now another economist, Sam Bowles of the University of Massachusetts, who spends half his time now at the Santa Fe Institute and is doing some very nice things there, Sam Bowles has pointed out that, not his own work, but through the work of other people, that with the collapse of communism in Central and Eastern Europe some years ago, major exceptions developed to this so-called law. And the departures were very significant from the 60% to 70% range. So there are two different reasons, maybe the second one more striking, for rejecting this as a real regularity. So we have to be careful to distinguish between alleged regularities and real ones. And the best way to do that is to try to understand why these regularities persist when they go on working in the face of changes in the underlying mechanism, huge changes in the underlying mechanisms. Now, some regularities are in the form of power laws. I remember hearing about those a long time ago when I was a graduate student at MIT in the 1940s. Hardly anybody spoke about them then. and they were considered anomalous, peculiar, rare, and so on. Now we realize that they're all over the place. power laws, one kind of power law, is the simplest perhaps, is power law of distribution, where the frequency of occurrence of a value of something is distributed like a power. So here are the numbers, the differential numbers of something, say x attaining the value x, goes like dx over x to the k plus 1. So here's x to a certain power in the denominator. Dn is then the number of cases between x and x plus dx, and it's going to like dx over a power of x. You can integrate this equation, then you get n plus a constant is a constant times 1 over x to the k. You can then solve for x, and you get x sub n goes like 1 over n plus a constant to the 1 over k. So you can, instead of this rough law of distribution, you can get this as the value, as a function of the ordinal number. The biggest one, the second biggest one, the third biggest one, the fourth biggest one. Let's take a particular quantity, income. Vilfredo Pareto, about a century ago, proposed such a law for income. It doesn't hold for all incomes, but it holds over a range, a considerable range of incomes. And so we have the number one income, the number two income, the number three income, and so on, following a law like this. Or, if you prefer, this differential law here. Now, the exponent, k, determines how flat or how steep the variation is of the number with income. So the gap between the rich and the poor in such a situation varies according to the steepness of the curve, varies according to the exponent k, which can change as you go from one society to another. Now suppose you want to use legislation to reduce, for some reason, the gap between the higher paid and the lower paid people. If you wanted to do that, maybe it would be wise, if this is a real regularity, if Pareto's law is a genuine, robust regularity, hard to break, maybe it would be best not to fight it, but to try instead to change the exponent, which we know can vary, and which would be a way of altering the flatness or steepness of the distribution. So this is an example of how these regularities can constrain attempts to influence society by means of public policy, as well as attempts to forecast the behavior of society. But you always have to be careful to try to find robust regularities, ones that are real, ones that are hard to change. Here's another example of power laws of distribution. The populations of metropolitan areas. I heard about this 1949 from my thesis advisor when George Kingsley Zipf was publishing his book. He was an instructor in German at Harvard, and he wrote an incomprehensible book on this stuff called The Principle of Least Effort. Turns out that this rule for the populations of metropolitan areas had been discovered earlier by Auerbach in 1913, but it's usually attributed to George Kingsley Zipf. So we can apply these power laws to metropolitan areas, and what happens is that there the exponent k is near 1, so that you get x sub n is roughly going like 1 over n, where n is the number, n is the rank. Number one for the most populous metropolitan area, number two for the second most populous metropolitan area, number three for the third, and so on. Now, for the first few values of n, this doesn't work too well, 1, 2, 3, 4. But when you get up to 20, 30, 40, it begins to work very well. And it works for the first few hundred numbers. So we can say, for instance, that the 300th city has about one-third the population of the 100th city, which is really quite remarkable. You can also look at it in terms of the first digit in the World Almanac. Look at the populations of metropolitan areas in an almanac and look at the first digit. This distribution means that the first digits are distributed in a very uneven way, so that the first digit is a 1 45 times more often than it's a 9, which is really very striking. But it comes from this 1 over n behavior, k equals 1. Now, there are explanations in the literature for k being near 1, but I don't really think they're very good so far. I think it hasn't really been properly explained. So like many of the other things we've been talking about, it's a regularity ranging over a wide variety of situations, persisting in the face of big differences underneath, and not 100% understood. One thing you can say about these power laws, without specifying the exponent, is that the power law and the log normal law, which is e to the minus constant log minus constant squared, these two laws are, for the logarithm, very similar to the very familiar laws, e to the minus x and e to the minus x minus c squared. This is the Gaussian. This is the exponential law. This usually applies to things that can be either positive or negative. This to things that have a lower limit, typically just positive. If you, for x, you substitute log x, you then get a power here, and here you get the log normal distribution. So when things are multiplicative instead of additive, then you're likely to get log normal instead of Gaussian, and you're likely to get a power law instead of this exponential behavior. So it's not so implausible to get these functions, but that doesn't specify the power. Here's another argument for a power law given by the remarkable social scientist, psychologist, economist, computer scientist, Herb Simon, the late Herb Simon. He said, imagine an organization with one boss, a certain number of people, say 6, reporting to that boss, then 6 people reporting to each of those, and so on and so forth. Then the number is going exponentially with the rank. And the suppose that there's a fixed fraction of salary as you go down the scale, then the salary is also exponential in the rank. And, of course, two exponentials are powers of each other. So the salary would then be a power of the number, or the number would be a power of the salary. So this would be a model that would yield a power law of distribution. You can invent various arguments for the power laws of distribution, but to get the actual exponent right is not so easy. And I'm not sure I believe any of the arguments for it. But I'd like to end by commenting that even though I'm arguing for paying a lot of attention to these principles, trying to find them, trying to find out which are right, trying to understand them, and trying to apply them to constraining predictions about the future and to constraining recommendations about public policy, I would like to emphasize even more that these fail to capture the biggest and most important features of the world and the future, and that it's extremely important to look at those, the qualitative features, the features having to do with things that stir human emotions, things that drive people to do things in numbers and to sometimes to extreme measures. There's an article in the, I think, in the Atlantic Monthly by a man named David Brooks, with whom I don't always agree, with a title given by William Crystal, with whom I certainly don't always agree. But I think there's some wisdom here. He's talking about the book, which I have somewhere here, Global Trends 2015, produced by a whole lot of social scientists under the chairmanship of somebody in the CIA. This was an attempt by the CIA to contact the community of scholars outside and put together some projections based on unclassified work together with social scientists of many different kinds. And it's a very impressive piece of work. But he complains that it's kind of bloodless, that it includes trends in all kinds of variables, but it doesn't include the great passions that move people. It doesn't deal with, in other words, the human beings in it are more stick figures. Appropriate, in fact, to a situation in which you're projecting trends involving masses of people, treated as masses, involving demographic change, involving environmental change, involving economic change, and so on, but usually statistical and general, and somewhat the kind of thing we've been talking about. It's extremely important to do that, but it's, I think, wrong to think that you've captured the essence of the future when you do it. You've left out many of the most important things. Apparently, Crystal referred to this as the elephantiasis of reason, and that's the title of Brooks's article. Let's see if I can quote something he says. The problem with the CIA's brand of analysis is that human beings believe things and feel passions. They have visions of a future world and are often willing to sacrifice themselves or at least to take amazing risks to bring those visions about. Their gauge of reality can be radically different from that of a cool scholar at an antiseptic research campus. Bureaucracies just don't think well. Propelled by their scientific training and their desire to quantify, intelligence technocrats find themselves modeling further and further into abstraction, leaving behind the lessons of history, the clash of ideas, the passions of the soul, all those things that can't be rationalized but are the real drivers of human affairs. So while I'm recommending studying all these things, I don't recommend considering them to be the whole of the whole of the issue. Thank you.
You've been listening to Nobel laureate and Pardee visiting professor Dr. Murray Gell-Mann speaking on Regularities and Randomness in the Past and the Future. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skoog and Matt Largie with help from Vince Fairchild. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.